Hi, this is Lex, and welcome to the FinTech Blueprint. It's your podcast about fintech, decentralized finance, digital banking, investing, robo-advice, artificial intelligence, and all the other frontier technology that is transforming financial services. To get more content, like an illustrated transcript of this conversation in your inbox, subscribe at fintechblueprint.com. So without further delay, let's jump into today's episode. Welcome, everybody, to today's conversation. I'm so excited to have with us Andre Cherney, who's the CEO and co-founder of Aspiration, a neobank that is fighting climate change and has a fantastically interesting story. And I'm really excited to talk to Andre about it. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. So we like to start the conversation by trying to learn about your path through your career and how you ended up in the position that you're in and the types of things that you think. Can you tell us a little bit about how you started, your education and sort of the early experiences that you had?
Definitely was not a straight line by any means to go do what we're doing today at Aspiration, but in some ways it makes sense through the rearview mirror as things sometimes do. I was fortunate enough to start my career 25 years ago now with an amazing opportunity at a very young age to work in the White House for then President Clinton and even more specifically for then Vice President Al Gore, working on a whole range of policy issues, but of course with Vice President Gore back in the 1990s, a lot of it was around what we were calling back then global warming, and really had very much a front row seat in working with him on his efforts to try to get people to pay attention to a oncoming threat that was at that point still very much something that was coming down the pike as opposed to something that people were seeing and experiencing on a daily basis, and trying to get people to pay attention, respond to that threat. Unfortunately, ultimately unsuccessfully at the time, and did a whole variety of things over the years after that point. But of course, think about that early experience a lot because of how much it is tied into what we're doing today at Aspiration.
Absolutely. Another thing that when I think back to the late 90s and of course Al Gore is the internet boom and, you know, the advocacy around technology and technology innovation. What was the view on the platform like around sort of frontier technologies that in your experience?
It was another piece of what we're doing today that was very much something we were thinking about back then, in the sense of Gore was really one of the first politicians to start thinking about and talking about the internet, of course, the famous joke that he invented the internet, but also the new economy. I worked with him back in 1997 on, I think it was probably the first major speech by an American politician talking about what we called back then the new economy, one with looking at the technological transformation that was emerging. And he went out very early to go visit with Bill Gates outside of Seattle and went around the country looking at some of these very early internet-based businesses. And coming out of that, I actually, in the late 90s, wrote a book called The Next Deal that really focused on this idea that the businesses of the future would be about personalizing products and services for people and empowering them as individuals. And again, very much another piece of how we think about what we're doing at Aspiration decades later.
It's amazing how some of these things, you know, rhyme and how you can notice a thing, but its constituents parts just aren't there yet. And it takes so like all these different bricks to build up until it's available. And I feel like through some of your early work, you were exposed to these ideas of community, of, you know, financial and political community. And then a lot of that was expressed through like policy work. Can you talk a little bit about what is the relationship between some of this, between a political body or a group of people in general, and then the idea of creating a policy? Can you talk about Like, what was that process to you, and what are the parts from which it's made?
Yeah, as I said, there, I feel like my career hasn't, of course, followed a straight path, but there's been, I think, some North Stars that have really helped provide a sense of what I care about and direction. And I, of course, would never have believed or foreseen that I was going to be working in fintech or financial services or anything along those lines. But the values that I cared about, the way in which I thought about the world, of course, informs what we're doing at Aspiration, as does the point of view of any of us who helped to build the company and start the company from day one.
And what are the tools by which, you know, you would implement that view? And of course, we'll get to talk about Aspiration and sort of the DNA of the firm that certainly scales the sump and ramps it up. But like, in your political life and in your engagement with the law and the various parts of government, how did you think about storytelling? How did you think about expressing policy views or prioritizing them for people? Like, what were the tools that were available to you in that part of your career?
To me, it was really always about how do you speak to and how do you think about a person as a whole. And we're all not just a series of transactions, but we all carry with us a certain view of ourselves and of the world around us. And I always thought that was important. You see in politics, really in both parties, sometimes a very transactional view. Give somebody a tax cut and they're going to respond in a certain way, or pass a spending program and people are going to respond in a certain way. But it's never that simple, because people are not just purely financial actors. We have a set of values and emotions, and those are as real as the dollars and cents in what we do. And so as I think back of what I always thought about back in those days, you know, now two decades plus ago, it was really this idea that you had to create the context for people and that larger story that we all find ourselves in, that we all view ourselves in as we go through our daily lives as individuals, as members of a family, and certainly as citizens as well.
That's a very beautiful answer and a complicated one. As you became more senior in the public service part of your career, whether it's for the Center for American Progress or whether it's your time as Assistant Attorney General in Arizona, what kinds of issues did you begin to be exposed to that maybe started to inform the direction of where you were going?
You know, certainly I already mentioned some of the work around climate, but a lot of my work in various different capacities was around financial opportunity, economic opportunity, and justice for people. And starting in 2004, 2005, co-founded a policy journal and, in essence, a think tank called Democracy. And one of the very first things we did was reach out to a law professor that I had gotten to know in public policy realm at Harvard named Elizabeth Warren, and said, "Are there anything you've been thinking about that we should maybe collaborate on?" And she said, "Well, yeah, I have this idea for what I've been thinking about, but I haven't really written anything on, for a financial product safety commission." And so we published the first piece of hers on that front and really raised money to start a campaign to get that idea out there and into the environment of conversation, whether in politics or op-ed pages, with the idea of saying that there really was not any regulatory body looking at consumer financial products. There is one, of course, for consumer products like toasters and so on, but not for financial products. And of course, that eventually became the CFPB 4 or 5 years later. And so very much saw that fight up close from day one. And, you know, as an assistant attorney general in Arizona, I really went in an opposite direction, where I'd been working on policy issues at a very much 30,000-foot level and in some ways got burnt out on that and wanted to see them up close and have a positive impact up close. And so as I was in that role, I was in court almost every day and prosecuting all kinds of consumer financial fraud cases, and had very much a different view on the day-to-day reality of what people were facing and the ways in which they were getting tripped up and taken advantage of. And so I really had, over the years, an opportunity to see a lot of these issues from from different vantage points that, of course, ended up being pieces of that mosaic that you bring into what you're doing.
So it's interesting. What I'm hearing a lot of is this human perspective, this perspective of how do people have an experience that is both, you know, caused by the finances of their lives, but finances as an attribute of their life. And then, you know, as an experience relative to institutionalism, you know, to market structures or to government structures or to sort of the interaction of the things that we build that are greater than ourselves. And you've taken a number of different views at this from different vantage points and the things that you've done. And so that takes us to 2013, which is sort of the year where the word fintech, I think, is finally starting to be used. And venture investors are getting comfortable with the idea that maybe finance isn't just how you run a bank, but also the way that people engage with it and the technology around it. And of course, all the heartache of 2008 plus is really, you know, pregnant in that moment. Can you talk to us about, I guess, that founding of Aspiration and what it is that you and your co-founders thought that you were moving forward with?
Yeah, you know, after after that time as a prosecutor, I had another career pivot and I was doing consulting and working at a large firm, and ended up that most of my time was spent working for large financial institutions, Bank of America and others. And we were being brought in to help them think about the full range of business challenges they were facing. But what became clear to me, and maybe because of that more human perspective on finances, was that as we were thinking about their challenges around customer retention and activity and so on, so much of it was traced back not necessarily to the products and services that they offer and how those can be tuned, but fundamentally to distrust. When you kept on pulling on the string, what became clear to me was that the challenge these institutions were facing was that fundamentally their customers just didn't trust them. Yes, trusted them to the extent that they thought that if they put $20 into an ATM, they'd be able to get $20 back out, but not that deeper level of trust, of that sense of my bank is on my side. It has my best interests at heart. It shares my values. These institutions were really, really nowhere on that front. And we were seeing that wave of fintech that was starting to gather speed in 2012, 2013, 2014. But it seemed to my co-founder and I that so much of it was geared around new kinds of products, new kinds of service, new algorithms, robo-advisors, and so on. And those all had a place. But if you were solving for product or technology or fees, that you were solving for only a piece of what was necessary, and that really it was important to solve for trust, and that the central challenge that most people had in their financial lives was that one, interests were misaligned with that of their bank. Clearly, that for most people, the bank makes more money when they make less, when they're doing worse in their life, when there's more overdraft fees, when there's more late fees, and so on. But also this misalignment of values. You know, going back to what we talked about of some of what I had thought about in previous chapters of my life, that people thought about their money, again, not just from a standpoint of dollars and cents, but what is the meaning of it, and what do they want to do with it, and what kind of life do they want to live? And that if we could create something that solved for both of those misalignments of both interests and values, then you'd really be able to unlock a very different kind of relationship with our customers and be able to create something that would not only do good for those people as individuals, but would have a larger positive impact. And that was the conversation that eventually ended up leading to Aspiration.
That's fascinating. And, you know, I want to know how that initial idea continued over, you know, the following years as you developed the business. You know, can you tell us a little bit maybe about the size of the business today, how many users you've got, like what kinds of customers you serve, and then we'll talk a little bit about how those foundational concepts evolved over time.
Yeah, you know, we, as I was saying, really thought about that trust question in terms of initial set of products of thinking about how do we take that ESG revolution out of the realm of just investing and bring it into people's day-to-day financial lives? How do we align their values by helping them make their spending and saving sustainable through their core bank accounts and debit cards and so on? And the business is involved in such a way that over time, we've really opened up the aperture of our thinking in the sense of from there, think about not just financial products, but actually sustainability products. As we were having millions of transactions with our customers, saw those as millions of moments of interaction and started building sustainability tools that would intersect with and sit on top of those financial tools, automated carbon offsetting, planting a tree with every purchase. And as that continued to grow, and now over 5 million members, as we call them, and a really vibrant community of people who are thinking about aspiration as not just a financial home, but a way to have a positive sustainability-focused impact, we brought a lot of the same tools to businesses. And now a very large chunk of what we do is bring climate change fighting tools to businesses. And so today, really think about ourselves as sustainability as a service, products, tools, features that will help both people and businesses integrate climate change fighting solutions into what they're doing on a daily basis and deliver that through our financial products to individuals and deliver it through other means to the businesses that we serve.
Yeah, I guess to just double click on that, right? 5 million members is a pretty big B2C fintech footprint. Can you talk about how you got there in terms of building that footprint and building the business, you know, and the desire to go beyond that? What's the decision making around that? You know, is fintech B2C distribution kind of like a tool to get to some end, or is it the end in itself? Like, tell us a little bit more about the machinery of that, of first that B2C side of the business.
For us, again, it's really thinking about how do we deliver sustainability? And our early DNA, of course, was around thinking about the sustainability of people's financial lives. But a financial product, again, is not just that means of conveying monetary transactions, but it is really something that is integrated into what people are doing every day. That debit card, that credit card that you're using on a daily basis is really one of the few products that you pick up and use multiple times a day for most people. And as time has gone on, we've, yes, thought about how do we help people make their money sustainable, but then also how do we use that as a jumping off point to make the rest of their lives sustainable. And so we started with first our core bank account and then made a shift to going independent and being the first consumer fintech in the US to really break off of a third party bank sponsor and create our own independent structure. And the value proposition there was really around how do we make sure that people's deposits are not being used in ways that are antithetical to their values? How do we help people make sure that their deposits are fossil fuel free and firearm free and private prison free and so on? How do we arm them with information around how their spending is having an impact on people and the planet? And so created our aspiration impact measurement. And so what we saw was, of course, just a series of new products, new tools, new innovations that deepened our customer relationship and deepened the ways in which we were able to deliver for those customers on that core proposition.
This is a really, it's a very interesting way to put it for me, because in a sense, you know, you have the behavioral motion of having a bank account or swiping a card and you know, like transacting. We're in a very commercial society, and we're constantly choosing through transaction and through consumption who we are, you know, and so you're building up your identity in a sense out of those choices. And what you're describing, you're almost describing it in a non-financial sense. You're describing it in a framing about values and then personal policy, about the things that people want to choose in order to represent, certainly to the world, but also to themselves about who they are. And, you know, I would expect that to create kind of a community reflection or a conversation or symptoms of cohesion that like a commoditized financial product just doesn't create. Can you talk at all about what you hear from the community, what kinds of conversations are happening to reflect these values, maybe where they're happening and how you're tapping into that?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. To me, really, the promise of fintech is around community in a just very basic way. Going back to some of what I was thinking about in the way that technology was transforming our lives in the late 90s, I think we're seeing that with fintech. And the real value is allowing people to join the communities that are really important to them. As you know very well, better than I, as your listeners know, it used to be that if you would want to build out a financial institution, especially a bank, it would be based on geographic communities. People went to the branch that was closest to them. If you wanted to build out your bank, you would build another branch in another part of town, or you'd acquire another bank in another part of the state or country and grow your geographic footprint and be able to serve more communities. Well, what we have now in the phone that we're all carrying around is the ability to open a bank account just as easily at Bank of America, Wells Fargo, Chase, Aspiration, Chime, Robinhood, Acorns, wherever else. What that means is that people are able to choose the institution that best speaks to them and that responds to their own community. And so for people who are, let's say, solving for a life where their core challenges and what they're thinking about is living paycheck to paycheck, there's a series of different financial options. And if they're a Henry who is highly earning and yet not yet rich, you'd be able to go to SoFi. And for Aspiration, we've always thought of ourselves as serving a very distinct community of conscious consumers, the people who are out there who are thinking about ethics, thinking about environmental sustainability as they're making decisions on a daily basis in the grocery store, buying clothes, buying coffee, deciding what kind of car to drive or not drive. And for those people, we wanted to create really an experience from soup to nuts, from the way the business operated, to the way the product operated, to the kinds of services and features that we offered. What we've found and what other research has found is that that community of conscious consumers is actually equally as large as the community of financial optimizers that almost everybody is going after in the financial industry. Almost everybody is finding different ways to serve and appeal to. And so we've been really almost on our own going after a path of finding ways to serve this community of conscious consumers. And to your point, they've responded. And we see people who are very much seeing themselves as an aspiration person, and that when they're putting down that aspiration card, it is a statement about who they are, the same way that if somebody's putting down an American Express gold card or what have you. And we see people, for instance, driving around with Aspiration bumper stickers. When you sign up for Aspiration Plus, which is our premium core account, we have something called Planet Protection that allows you to offset the carbon footprint of your driving automatically, just as you're going about your business and buying gasoline on your Aspiration card. And we'll send out these bumper stickers that say Planet Protector on board, or this car drives in neutral. I'd say there's probably not another bank or financial institution in the world that people are putting bumper stickers for on their own car. But again, it speaks to the way that people think about themselves at Aspiration as not just providing a financial product that we hope is a best-in-class financial product from an economic standpoint, but one that, as we've always said, allows you to both do well and do good.
I'm sure that there's plenty of, you know, KKR partner or Apollo leverage buyout stickers that people want to get onto their cars.
I've missed them.
Yeah, I haven't seen those out there. I'd love to dive one step deeper, actually, into the mechanics of two of the things you mentioned. And so one of them is sort of a depository solution that makes sure that the banks or the credit unions or, you know, wherever the money sits is aligned with certain types of spending and certain types of loans. So I'd love to double click on that. And then also I think is really interesting just the detail of how you create the programs for that are supporting the climate change investment in terms of like, how do you actually build out like reforestation and the other things that you do? Like, what are the mechanics of it? So if you could touch on the machinery and the substance of both the depository bit and then the tree planting bit, like how you built those programs, that would be great.
Yeah. As I mentioned earlier, I think we're the first neobank in that sense to break off of a third-party bank sponsor and create our own structure back in 2018. We saw really the handwriting on the wall of the challenge of being tied into a third-party bank that really controlled your destiny, as well as controlling your economics. Because, of course, that bank, if you're an account holder at just about any of the neobanks that people think of out there, that bank that's underlying that product and marketing layer really holds the cards. And so we knew long-term that wasn't going to be the right solution. By the same token, we didn't want to go down the path of a bank charter. That's not really our core business. We're not doing lending. We're not balancing assets and liabilities. And so what we did was really recreate our offering with a cash management account structure. And so regulated by FINRA as opposed to the Fed, but created something that from a customer standpoint would be basically identical to a traditional checking or savings account, from paper checks to debit card to mobile app to FDIC insured deposits. And we did that by creating a sweep network where we're able to have our customers' deposits be kept in omnibus trust accounts in banks around the country that we have gone out and certified as being fossil fuel free and so on in their own lending practices. And they have to certify that to be part of our sweep network. And that has allowed us to really be able to have a guarantee around how customers' deposits are going to be used and not used. The real fact is that the largest banks out there are in many ways the primary drivers of the climate crisis. The biggest banks in the world are financing more oil and gas pipelines and drilling on a daily basis than ExxonMobil will do so in a year. And it just gets back to that old adage about follow the money. That's where the money to finance the climate crisis is coming from. And so there's a lot of our customers who have come to Aspiration because they don't want their own money being used in ways that counteract all of the positive impact that they're trying to have in all these other aspects of their lives. And so that's been a real driver of that Aspiration relationship. And as I said, as we've gone on, we've built these climate change fighting tools on top of the traditional financial tools. One of them was Planter Change, which we introduced in the first part of 2020 that allows our customers to plant a tree with every purchase they make by rounding up that purchase to the nearest dollar. And we introduced it right when COVID was beginning to hit and planted that way, but that's what happened. And we're unsure what to see, but saw enormous take up for that product, maybe because of something like COVID happening and people seeing the need for individual action. And with that, and with the ability to bring similar services to enterprises, we've seen this set of services explode and now running what is probably the largest private sector tree planting operation in the world. We've funded the planting of over 50 million trees this year in 2021. That is more trees than there are in Central Park being planted every 2 hours. And so it's an enormous scale, and do so with NGO partners that are very well respected and that we work with very closely on the ground in places around the world, who are allowing us to have this positive climate impact at a scale that's really unlike that of any other institution in the world.
I mean, it's both refreshing and really surprising, right, to have like a conversation with a company that lots of people think, I was like, oh, that's a fintech, that's a neobank. But underneath it, you have this really deep mission, and sort of the secret sauce is like embedded climate change fighting tools through an API married with financial value. And, you know, to me, that's just a symptom of an incredible technological moment that that we're in now where people can kind of remix and collage together business models as well as sort of things they believe in a way that wasn't really available to entrepreneurs before. And that type of thing actually making sense in the capital markets, because retail has a very different hand these days in the capital markets. Retail investors can will into existence and as well as completely destroy companies in a way that, you know, 5 years ago, nobody would have thought possible. Can you talk a little bit about Aspiration's relationship with capital markets, with fundraising, with the SPAC process, whatever you can say, because I think the ability to be public, the ability to be held and to reflect the values of people holding the stock is kind of really important. So whatever you can share around the thought process and then the mechanics of what you've been doing in sort of the capital markets world.
Yeah, we decided in the early part of 2021 that it made sense for Aspiration to look at entering the public markets. There has been a enormous growth in ESG investing, both on the retail space, as you said, but also these very large mandates at the institutional level around ESG investing. And the ability for Aspiration to, in essence, make history as the first ESG-focused financial institution to be publicly listed and to be able to provide a way for ESG investors to have exposure to the financial industry was really attractive and exciting, and allowed us to think about how do we take that next step in our own journey and building that Aspiration brand and telling that Aspiration story. And so in August of 2021, we announced our plans to go public via SPAC through a merger with InterPrivate 3. And we're in that process now as we're recording this. It's a long process of getting all of the pieces buttoned up in terms of the SEC approval, but anticipating a public listing in the first half of 2022.
One of the things that we often look at with like anxiety and a lot of scrutiny is this gap between the private markets and the public markets that, you know, since 2010 and 2013 and the start of fintech venture investing, you know, there's almost no animals more different than a blitzscaling venture capitalist and a conservative banks analyst at, you know, an asset management company. And over the last couple of years, we've started to have this kind of rationalization or like negotiation between the private markets and the public markets for technology innovation related to finance. What's been your experience with sort of both of those types of parties as you navigate the SPAC process? And, you know, how do you see those things coming together, those views coming together?
I think it's especially interesting for Aspiration because we're creating this new category, not just in sustainability-focused consumer finance, but as I said before, in sustainability as a service more broadly, only about 30% of our company's revenue comes from what is traditionally seen as financial service revenue streams. Only about 30% comes from interchange or interest income or subscription or other financial products, and 70% comes from what we think of as ESG impact services that we're providing to both consumers and to businesses. And so as we're telling our story, we're having to reach beyond the financial industry analysts, the fintech analysts, and be able to talk about both how we do have some of that DNA, but what we're doing is a lot broader than those traditional ways of looking at what a fintech does and how it operates and how it makes money.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast and telling both your fascinating story and the story of the company. If our listeners wanted to learn more about you and about Aspiration, where should they go?
Aspiration.com is a great place to start. Download the Aspiration app, sign up for our spend and save account or our new Aspiration Zero credit card, which is something we're really excited about as well.
Andre, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Hi, everyone. That's it for this week's episode of the FinTech Blueprint. For more technical deep dives into all things fintech and decentralized finance, check out fintechblueprint.com and grab a free subscription to the newsletter. This is Lex, and I'll see you next time.